Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Full or part-time options, 518-454-5143.
And Rosenbaum Media Group, a digital communications agency integrating high-definition video into PR, marketing, advertising, and social media campaigns. Big-picture thinking for local and national clients. RosenbaumMedia.com.
From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
So the Media Project is here, and we're going to hopefully keep you entertained and enlightened and thrilled over the next half hour or so. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with Ira Fussfeld of the Daily Freeman in Kingston.
Hello, sir. I'm ready to entertain and thrill.
Absolutely, thrill. And truly thrilling, of course, is Dr. Alan Chartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio.
Why do I have a feeling you have a tongue in your cheek when you said that?
Tongue planted firmly in cheek. Well, I don't know.
You have your cheek.
Three old white guys sitting here. We're not going to be thrilling. What can you do? But, you know, we had a little controversy last week that we need to follow up on because we had a letter from a reader. Kathy from North Bennington wrote to say that she was shocked, she says, when Rosemary endorsed the New York Post publishing of the subway photos. That is, the fellow who was about to run over the train. Rosemary thought that that was justifiable. And
she wrote her back.
And she wrote her back. And Rosemary said, thank you for writing. And I understand your point of view. Basically, Kathy from North Bennington said, could you imagine losing a loved one in that horrendous way and having the moment of death splashed over the front pages where is simple human compassion and decency and all of this?
I agree.
Mm-hmm. I disagree. I thought Rosemary was spot on. I think it was a tremendous news picture. It was a dramatic news picture. There are a lot of things that the New York Post does that make me cringe, and this wasn't one of them. I just thought it was just a picture I would have used, and I'm squeamish on a lot of pictures. I just thought it was a dramatic picture. And I guess the other question I'd ask, it's happened in the last couple of days, is you had this shooting in Manhattan. A guy was shot point blank on 58th Street and 7th Avenue. And then the New York Times, among others, used a picture that the police released of the guy who was just about to shoot him, pulling the gun out of his pocket. Is that the same picture? What's wrong with that?
Let me just step in here and say, you know how much I admire you, Ira.
Yes.
And you know how much I respect you and all of your work, right?
Uh-oh, here it comes.
But you guys disgust me.
You're just playing to the crowd.
And here's why. Anything you do, you circle the wagons, you guys, and you justify it and say, no, it was a bad idea. And there's a difference. The Times was quite correct, and I hate to say that, but they were quite correct, and here's why. They're looking for this guy. They're looking for the guy who did it, right? The police are. So they released the picture, and somebody's going to come up and say, I know that guy. And that's different.
Why didn't they crop it so that we didn't have to see him pulling the gun out of his pocket? They used the picture because it was a dramatic picture just before the fatal shooting.
Yeah, well, now they have both ways. Now they do both. So I don't agree with you, and I am really sick and tired of you and Rex trying to justify every single thing that you do that's wrong.
Well, but I
and that your industry
Rex
does
was
wrong.
Rex was not on Rosemary's side last week.
I feel troubled about this, but I like Rosemary's answer, who said with respect to the subway photos, I do think, she said, that news is often unkind. I would not want my relative's photo in the Post, but we do not produce news for relatives or survivors. And that's really true. You know, we often get that. How would you feel if it was your family? Well, I would hate it, but that's not the judgment that I have to make.
I can't do
that on the basis of families.
Except, Mr. Rex Smith, let me say that one could project themselves. Everybody has relatives, or most people have relatives, and they have sensitivities. And it may not be that it's the individual's family, but everybody else has family. Say, I wouldn't want them to do that to me. And that ends up not being one or two people, but, you know.
Well, then by what basis do you do stories about public corruption? If you had a corrupt relative, you wouldn't want your relative splashed all over the newspapers either or on the airwaves of WAMC.
That is perfectly ridiculous.
It is absolutely accurate. So you wouldn't do any news at all because news is often hard to swallow if you're personally involved. So let's just not do anything that makes anybody uncomfortable. Now, there's a great news standard, Alan.
And I'm sure everybody's listening is on to you, Rex. And they know that, and they know exactly what you're trying to pull here. And we're not buying it, none of us.
The fact I'm buying it.
No. Yeah, I think that many people actually are buying it.
I said you two guys are together. There's no question. You know, when a public official is corrupt and goes to jail and it looks terrible and or gets out of jail and it looks terrible, there's a message there.
This New York Post picture with, of the subway, all of these sanctimonious broadcasters who were saying what a dastardly thing that the New York Post did so as they held up the picture so that everybody on their audience could see it.
Well, there is that.
That's terrible.
And that just
terrible.
Shows what your crowd is like.
It's not my crowd.
It's your crowd. No, you're the Kelly McBride of the Poynter Institute, who is one of the foremost ethicists in journalism, says that there's a difference. She says, in the street photo, we're seeing a crime unfold.
Exactly.
In the subway photo, we're seeing a futile moment of struggle. So as opposed to the photo of the fellow in the subways, Kelly McBride says there is journalistic value in the street photo for two reasons. A, publishing it makes it likely to catch a guy, as you said.
The Allen answer. And by the way, I did not read that.
And B, we can document and share the documentation of a cold-blooded murder. So interesting, because society can't function, she says, if people get away with premeditated murder. So,
and if the picture had been snapped a split second later and the only picture they had was of the actual shooting, would that have been run for the same reasons that she describes, that it's a crime and we're looking for the person?
It depends on whether it's newsworthy. Think about the power of that photo that we still think of from Vietnam, photo of Vietnam of the person being executed in cold blood by a pistol shot to the head, where we do see that moment of death. Now, Alan, by your standard, you wouldn't want that applied to a relative of yours, so...
We stop that.
That's your standard.
It does not make you look good, Rex. It makes you look terrible because it's a spurious argument. In that case, I gave the rationale for the Times. In that case, it became the face of the war which we were engaged in, and that our side and our allies were doing terrible things. So it really had a political and social purpose. You can't lump everything into the same little midget car.
But isn't the social purpose of the New York Post photography, I can give you two reasons to take Rosemary's side here and to take Ira's side, that for the social purpose is one, to show the danger of perhaps untreated mental illness. You know, it was a result of an incident like this that we got laws in New York State that require the administration of drugs that can discourage this type of behavior. Second, the social purpose is the presentation of truth, to show people what's really going on in society. If we discourage this kind of photography, if we begin to say, you know, certain types of truth we're just not going to show because it's just too distasteful to the relatives of people who have to see it.
No, because there's no redeeming moral or social purpose for this.
And the presentation of accuracy is not a redeeming social purpose in itself?
The presentation of accuracy. You know what, Rex? I suggest you take this very spurious argument and bring it to the Pew lectures that you give of the other places where you guys all hang out and pat each other on the back, because it just doesn't fly.
Well, what I think that this
here comes your aid.
No, what I think this particular case shows, for those who believe the media walk in lockstep, is that this is a picture that has created a lot of interest and a lot of divisiveness, but varying opinions among professional long-term newspaper editors. And here's Rex Smith, who is as respected a newspaper editor as you can find, who does not want to run that picture. And there are any number of other editors who would run it, and all of them are coming from a good place. So it's just, they're just not easy decisions to make.
What does that mean, they're all coming from
From a good place.
Nirvana?
No, the good place is the desire to put out a publication that is accurate and that is relevant and is informed.
And you know this how? You're in their heads? You know where they're coming from?
I've been hanging around them for 42 years.
Oh, well, then that makes all the difference.
Most journalists are people of high ethical standard and goodwill.
Most
people in
the
position. It's true.
I'm not giving up on this, Rex.
Another example would be the photos from Fallujah, which we were criticized for publishing. I did put those in the front page, and that is at a certain stage during the war in Iraq. three Americans who were working as contractors. Basically, they're former service members who were doing quasi-military work in Iraq, were murdered, their corpses burned, and then dragged through the streets behind cars and hanged from a bridge.
Sure.
I put that photo of the burned corpses hanging from a bridge on the front page because I thought that it was a significant presentation of what was really going on in Iraq, despite the claims of the Bush administration to the contrary that you know, mission had been accomplished.
Well, I say congratulations to you, and here's why. You were right, because again, as in the case of Vietnam, with the pistol to the head, that showed the American people what was going on in this so-called war.
But it's not that he was right. It was his determination that that was a picture that should be used. Any number of other newspapers didn't use it.
Right.
I can tell you, I was very uncomfortable with our newspaper when we printed the pictures of Saddam Hussein's dead sons.
Yeah.
And those were very graphic pictures. And the rationale was you wanted to prove that they actually got him. I mean, we ran them, but I didn't care for it. And there are a number of papers that didn't run it.
Well, there's a big difference.
There was no right or wrong.
There's a big difference between whether you cared for it and whether you ran it. Do you understand the dichotomy there, right?
Well, we ran it because I let the editors have the final determination. I could have quashed it, but I didn't want to do that.
Well, that's a cop-out.
No, it's not a cop-out. This is what we pay the editors to do. In this case, I bow to their judgment, their news judgment. But again, I don't think there's a question of right or wrong. Every case is different, and you make a judgment based on what you see and what you think you need to do.
There was huge dispute after 9/11 in which photographs to run and which not.
Sure.
The most famous one probably shot by Richard Drew of the AP, showing a guy, probably a chef, plummeting downward who had leapt off the high floor, perhaps the windows in the world. And it was a remarkable piece of photojournalism, in part because of the visual of it, the verticality of the lines of the World Trade Center and this body plummeting in front of it. But and we ran it on an inside page, but it was a hard thing because you saw the last instant of that person's life.
So do you think this inside page, outside page business is, can you be a little bit pregnant?
Yeah, it's funny. Regarding the subway picture, I saw an interview where the media guy from the Washington Post said, if you're going to run it and you think it's newsworthy, then run it where it belongs, on the front page.
So, that's interesting. Yeah. I don't know that I agree with that, because I think that there sometimes you need to play a photo in context or play it in a way that the truth is conveyed, but you don't make it sensational by giving the impression that you're using it to sell newspapers. Although typically when you run a photo that's controversial, you actually, it's bad for you because people are angry. So people say, oh, you're just running that to sell newspapers.
Well, some people are saying that.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of people talking about it and buying the paper for that reason.
I bet you we will not be around to see it, but in 50 years, maybe a little longer than that, a lot of the pictures that were not printed from 9/11 will be printed. The historians will go back. You know, you see a lot of pictures from World War II, from the concentration camps. I don't know whether they were widely disseminated during their time, but you see them now all the time on the History Channel, if nowhere else.
Well, you know, my barber, Joe B. Ritmo.
What?
My barber, Joe B. Ritmo, has all of the Time Life books from World War II, from the beginning until the end.
Uh-huh.
And that was a fairly conservative organization now, let's face it, but they had, in those books, they have incredible pictures.
Which I wonder if they used at the time in their publications.
That's exactly right. You make a good point.
Now, does he let you read them while you're in the chair?
No, you wait. You have a choice.
Okay.
He has some very interesting reading material there. And and he also has the Time Life books.
Yeah.
I read the Time Life books because I'm old and decrepit.
Right.
But there are others who might read the other stuff.
But while you're in the chair.
No, no.
Oh, because the pictures get hairy, you know. You wouldn't necessarily be actual see the real image.
Well, this is a big contribution to our show.
It's important to keep this. If you wish to be part of this conversation, we are media.
Who could expect why?
Why would you wish that? Media at WAMC.org. Send it to us, media at WAMC.org. Ira Fussfeld of the Daily Freeman, Alan Shartok of WAMC, and I'm Rex Smith of the Times Union, here to share some thoughts with you, and we're always happy to hear from you and maybe swipe some of your ideas and use them as our own.
I would change that to say most of the time we're happy to hear from you.
Yes, that's true. Sometimes we just say, oh,
because sometimes people are not that, you know, really nice. They're provocateurs.
No. Imagine that.
But that's an interesting question. You know, we all assume that we have great jobs, and we do. But we do get mail at our desks, and some of them are from
And phone calls.
And phone calls. Some of them are from lunatics.
And sometimes.
And so the question then becomes, how do you play it? I have a rule, which is one shot back. In other words, they send me a thing and I say, thank you very much for your contribution. Well, if they're encouraged and they write another long, long and blasphemous and terrible letter, I ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
And I file it under.
Yeah. Under your desk is where you file
it. No. I have a file which is just in case one day I'm not here via somebody's actions.
Ah.
They can look in this file and say, here are a bunch of suspects.
Okay, you potential assassins. You are on notice.
Well, some of the things you read in the paper. I read it in the Daily News. There was a story in one of the tabs this morning about how somebody had hired two thugs to take Justin Bieber's manhood away.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And it was not on the front page, but it was there, and it was very shocking.
And so, Justin Bieber doesn't even play the banjo.
And if they could do that to him, they could do it to me.
All right. Here is some interesting research that suggests different.
I always love it when you guys laugh at each other's
play.
If we won't, who will?
A different play of stories depending upon whether they're online or in print. And this prompts an interesting question. But these are professors like yourself, Dr. Chartok, in this case at the University of Oregon School of Journalism and Communication, who are looking at Seattle and Minneapolis, comparing the play of stories online and in print. And they discovered that the online, the digital versions of the metropolitan newspapers were much more likely to give higher play to crime stories than the print version was. That old saying about television, if it bleeds, it leads.
Sure.
Well, that seems to be the case for digital news as well compared to what's in print. Now, Ira, since your company is called Digital First Media.
Well, I'm wondering whether the newspapers that they looked at for that survey are as sophisticated as, say, the New York Times website, which is very much built like a newspaper. So my point being, most sites have shells of our front page, our homepage, where we will put news on the front page of the website because it's fresh and because that's where the fresh stories go, as opposed to putting it on the inside police news pages. So I don't know if that's a factor. I can tell you the part of the argument the guy is saying, the survey is showing, is that these crime stories get not only better play, but better viewership. And whether they're in print or online, there's no doubt that crime sells newspapers.
No question. Yeah. Can I change the subject for a moment?
So well, we were to talk about
you. Are you bored with this one already? Yeah, okay.
Yeah. You made the point. The famous Andrew Borowitz, Borowitz Report, gave a presentation for WAMC at the Bardavon Theater down in Poughkeepsie. And he's a big satirist of the press. He's very funny.
Hmm.
And one of the things he did was that he showed us how he has been, in his Borowitz report, has been citing this guy named Logsdon. And he, of course, since he is a satirist, he can do whatever he wants. He makes that point. And he keeps using this guy as a expert. No matter what the subject of the story, this guy logs in, it showed up 10,000 times. And it's always at the University of Minnesota because it's so bland and out there. And says, who's been studying this issue. So I just want you to know that I was very impressed with that. And because I think sometimes people get away with things. And we read about them every once in a while, you know, experts who really aren't.
Fell right off the. But if
that sometimes happens. People
sometimes
who pose as experts. I can't imagine.
So you don't get it, but okay. You just don't get it. All right. Okay, Rick.
That's fine. Never mind. No, I think it's very interesting. And
no, you don't.
Borowitz was a fabulous comedian and satirist of contemporary life. That's
especially
true.
The press.
That part is true.
And you deserve whatever you get.
And you're not a part of it. No. We don't do any journalism here at WAMC,
I'm
right?
I'm an outsider.
I see. Absolutely. Right. That's it. That's fine. You just read our stories online and into the microphones, and we'll be fine.
So the
mainstream
unkind.
Press bungled this. Well, that's your note.
No, we always have your guys on,
Fair
and we
not.
Always name them, and we say Jimmy Vilkind did a great story on this and that.
I do appreciate
you,
that.
You know
I don't
that.
See how you
so
can
there's
say
no
that.
Reason, there's no reason to take that tone.
That you're not, but you never accept any of the responsibility for journalism. You know,
no, it's good journalism.
Oh, I see. That's what's done here. Unlike the rest of us here,
professorial journalism.
The biggest story of the 2012 campaign. says Dan Frumkin, who is a media analyst. He writes for Nieman Reports, which is a Harvard publication. He says the press bungled the single biggest story of the 2012 campaign, and that is by failing to point out the actual disparity in truth-telling between one side and the other. This is a result of Thomas Mann and Norman Ornstein, who have written a book now.
I know they were.
And the fact of the matter is, he says, the radical right-wing off-the-rails lurch of the Republican Party being the biggest story of the campaign, and the mainstream media, he says,
that's right. And Borowitz makes that point, and so does Professor Logsdon.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite expert.
From Minnesota.
The trap of balance, they say. But overall, he says, man, it was a pretty disappointing performance. Ornstein, who is a scholar of the American Enterprise Institute, which is a conservative outfit.
He's conservative, and the other guy plays a moderate liberal. I can't recall a campaign
where I've seen more lying going on. He says that Democrats were hardly innocent, but it seemed pretty clear to me that the Republican campaign was just far more over the top, a big lie campaign, and that we in the media generally failed to make that distinction.
Lionel Trilling, he said, he wrote a poem, Pete Seeger played it on the banjo, and it was just, when in trouble, just, I lie.
You know, I haven't read the report. I'm familiar with it, and I'm sure that there's an element of truth in it, and I don't want to be too defensive about my great profession, but it just seems to me a couple of things.
No.
One is there were plenty of commentators in print and on the air that pointed out the lies that these guys suggest that the media ignored. So I don't believe that that's the case.
But taken as an entity,
all right, here's the other point, and this is where I'll tee one up for you. I think that this is an example of we in the media following our instincts and our training, which is to do it neutrally as possible. And if one side says something, we get them, and then we get the other side, and we let the readers or the listeners to decide in the news columns themselves. And if, in fact, this campaign is something that's going to make us turn the corner, well, maybe we'll have to turn the corner, but that's your instinct is not to do that, my instinct is not
bullpucky,
to do that.
Bullpucky, and I'll tell you
why.
I'm going to tell you, because the incentive was to make a race out of something. The great Andy Borowitz made this point, to make a race out of something that is not a race. Obama was going to win it. And after that first debate, he lost it, he was terrible, he was this, he was that.
All of that is true.
Yeah. Well, not necessarily.
Oh, come on.
Point is, it was in the interest to make the horse race, you people did incessantly campaign.
No, that's such an easy, cheap shot, and it's so unfair.
It's easy because it's true.
It could have been a very close race. It could have gone the other way. It really almost did.
Well, anything, the asteroid, which was 4 million miles off, could have hit us.
And now to say in retrospect that the press built it up to be a close presidential race when it wasn't is absolutely fraudulent commentary.
Don't use words like fraudulent or I will meet you on the Weehawken plane.
But you mean to tell me that if you were a daily reader of the New York Times or any other newspaper in this country that has commentary pages, that the lies that these guys suggest were going on were not covered and commented on?
They were covered and commented on. The biggest lie of the campaign was that, according to PolitiFact, was the Romney ad saying Jeep is going to be moving its production facilities to China, pointed out in the press right at the time as being untrue, disputed by the president, the CEO of Chrysler, and yet, it still kept going on. But we pointed it out. We did.
Yes, but the problem once again, we've been there before, is that the conservatives are watching Fox, the liberals are watching MSNBC or whatever.
That's a broader problem.
And then, therefore, they don't really listen to that stuff.
That stuff. All right.
We ran long, but we can cut the story out that neither of us understand.
We'll talk to you next week, folks.
So long.
Reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk. Pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people.